Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, everyone. This is Susan Thompson of Colgate University, a host on New Books Network and African Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for tuning in. Today, my guest is S. Garnett Russell. She's an assistant professor of international and comparative education and the director of the George Clement Bond Center for African Education at Teachers College, Columbia University in New York City. Her book is titled Becoming Rwandan: Education, Reconciliation, and the Making of a Post-Genocide Citizen, published by Rutgers University Press in 2020. In it, Garnett argues that although the Rwandan government makes use of global discourses in its national policy documents, the way in which school teachers and students they teach engage with these global discourses, these global models, actually distorts the curricular intention of the government, resulting in a series of unintended consequences and, of course, an undermining of sustainable peace. Garnett, thanks for being here. I'm looking forward to speaking to you today.
Thanks, Susan, for the introduction and for having me on the show today.
Perfect. I wanted to start with a comment. Could you summarize your book for those who don't know much about Rwanda and who might be keen to pick up your book? How would you summarize
my book? Yeah, sure. So my book addresses the broader question of how countries that have undergone violent intergroup conflict use the education system to promote reconciliation and peace building, and also address the violent past. So in the case of Rwanda, I was interested in how the government is drawing on these global models, specifically in national education policy documents, curricula, and textbooks, and then how teachers and students engage with these models in the school level. So I think you did a great job of summarizing it previously.
Oh, good. So the book is definitely about education. And that's, I think, my first question for you. How many Rwandans actually have access to education? And what sort of sample are we talking about in your study?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think, one thing I wanted to focus on in the book is just how in post-genocide Rwanda, the government is really using education as part of their unity and reconciliation project and to promote this new Rwandan identity. And it's also really seen as a sort of a solution to the past conflicts and genocide. So one thing that was done under the RPF after the genocide, they expanded basic education to 9 years in 2009 and then to 12 years in 2011. So this was just around the time that I was doing my field work. And so I think that's something that's remarkable, is that there's just been an expansion in access to basic education. So I have some figures, for instance, in 1999, the net enrollment in primary was 79%. And then it was up to 95% in 2015. So there has also been increase in access to secondary education, but not as much. And of course, tertiary is lower. But I think the issues remain in terms of quality not being as high across all the different schools. There's still high dropout rates, low transition, you know, to the upper levels. So, I mean, I think it's compared to, you know, before the genocide, there's been a huge expansion, and that's seen as a success story in terms of the work of the government.
You know, you raise a really interesting set of questions there. How many, like, can the average Rwandan access quote unquote free education? One thing that the research shows is that it may be free, but there are lots of barriers to access for the average person, average student. They need a uniform. They need books. Like, they have to sort of self-fund. Is that true in your research? Did you find that in your research? And secondly, there must be a big distinction between urban learners and rural learners. Rwanda has such a sizable divide in terms of rural and urban. What did your research find?
Yeah, so in terms of access to education, I would say that access is pretty universal at this point to at least to primary education. So, you know, they've done a lot to get rid of the school fees and requirements such as uniforms and textbooks. I think there are sort of informal barriers that might arise. I mean, my research didn't focus specifically on that. But from what I could see, you know, and I did work both in urban and rural areas, and I think that's really important to point out, because there is a huge disparity in terms of the quality of education. So the schools in the capital, Kigali, are much higher quality. You know, they have access to better resources, better teachers. A lot of the students there were fluent in English, whereas in the rural areas, I had to rely on my research assistants to interpret in, you know, Kinyarwanda or in some cases in French. So I think that's where you see the variation, the urban, rural, and also the types of schools. So I also looked at different types of schools.
Right.
So some schools are just, the boarding schools are seen as higher quality and they have better funding and they're harder to access. Whereas like the basic education schools, which the government built very quickly when I was there, they were just adding on, you know, schools to the primary schools so they could, the students can continue to study, but the quality tends to be lower in those types of schools, basic education schools.
Yeah, that's a great segue to my next question. You did your doctoral research in Rwanda. What brought you to the study of, you know, education and peace building in Rwanda? Is there a backstory there?
Yeah, so I guess I've always been interested in these issues around peace building and human rights. And I think the focus on education was very much shaped by my time working for UNESCO. And I worked in the Asia Pacific region for several years on the Education for All initiative. And I spent some time working in Nepal during the civil war, and also in the refugee camps in Thailand along the border of Myanmar. So that's really when I became interested in the issues of the role of the education system in conflict affected and post-conflict contexts. And that led me, when I went to do my PhD in international comparative education, I was very much interested in looking at a post-conflict setting. So I ended up looking at Rwanda, just because Rwanda, for anyone who studies these issues, it's such an emblematic case. And also I was interested in Rwanda because they've actually been doing a lot in terms of the reforms in the curriculum. So I also was thinking about Burundi at one point, doing a comparison, but not much had been done there. So I think Rwanda, because of all of these reforms, and if you look at their textbooks and curricula, you know, they do talk about peace building and human rights and these global ideas that, you know, you might expect to find. So I think that's what really attracted me to the case of Rwanda, is that they were engaging with these global discussions. So I wanted to see how they actually implemented them in the classroom, and also the reaction of local actors to these ideas.
I mean, you do that in the book. You speak of this norms cascade, as we know, is part of the political science literature. But before we get to that, what would you say, in your estimation, makes Rwanda an emblematic case of how global norms of education for peace building are made real in people's lives?
I guess it's emblematic because they obviously, you know, the 1994 genocide, and then sort of the way they've responded to the aftermath of the genocide. And, you know, now it's 27 years after the genocide. And I know there's a lot of critique as well for other things, but at least in terms of these global ideas around, you know, the Millennium Development Goals or the Sustainable Development Goals, particularly in health or gender equality or education, Rwanda is often held up as an example of a model. And I think particularly in education, they've just done a lot to expand access. And then, of course, around gender equality, you know, having the highest proportion of women in parliament in the world and access to healthcare. So I think that's something that intrigued me, right? As a scholar, you know, they're doing really well in these particular areas. And I was curious about how they were using the education system, you know, as part of the broader peace building process.
It's so interesting because, of course, the current Rwandan leadership, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, frames itself as an exception to most of these global discourses. But one thing your book does, and I think it's really interesting, is show us how they actually cascade into the lives of the ordinary student, the ordinary teacher. And that's my next question for you. Can you talk about like the education system in Rwanda? What are we looking at in terms of this norms cascade? The government has produced a particular curriculum. Are teachers involved in that curriculum? And then could you secondly talk us through like what is a day in the life in a private school and a day in the life of a public school student?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I think in terms of the curricular reforms, the old curricula after the genocide was completely destroyed. So one of the teachers I worked with had kept one of the old history books that I think they were burned or something because they were seen as biased. So when they created the new curricula, and I was looking specifically at civics education and history, I think they were really trying to align it with more sort of global ideas about these topics. So for instance, the new civics education curriculum, they created a new curricula in 1999 and then 2008. They had funding from UNICEF and the ICRC. So I think they were very much in line with sort of global ideas about what civics education should look like. So talking about, you know, human rights and peace building and these types of things. And then in terms of the history curriculum, there was a moratorium on the teaching of history after the genocide until 1999. So there was no curricula or textbooks. And then they actually solicited the involvement of UC Berkeley and Facing History and ourselves to produce a new history curriculum. But then that was that process. I talk about that in the book. It was a bit fraught, I would say. So they ended up producing their own textbook that was sort of based on that project, but then it wasn't really in line with what, you know, history as, you know, they had envisioned it as having, you know, different narratives, different versions, sort of open discussion about, you know, sources, primary sources. It was more the official version of history that they wanted to teach.
Right.
So that's what happened. They came out with the new curriculum. It was much later though, like 2008 and then 2010, and then the textbooks didn't come out until around when I was there, 2010, 2011. So, and then they recently redid the curriculum in 2015, and now they're very much focused on this idea of core competencies. So I think they are very much trying to align themselves with what they see globally and sort of, you know, what UN organizations or NGOs might encourage them to focus on. I think in terms of your second question about the daily life of students in a private versus a public school. So I think that interesting about Rwanda as compared to other countries, I mean, Rwanda, it's a very, the education system is very centralized, right? So all of the schools have to follow the same curriculum and use the same textbook. So regardless of whether they're public or private, I also had the schools that were religious. So they they receive money from the government as well. So you don't actually find that much difference in terms of those three different types of schools that I included in my study, because they all have to follow the government curricula and they all use the same textbooks. So I think the differences are more in terms of the quality of the schools, and the more elite schools, for instance, in the capital, they just have better resources and better funding. But in terms of what they're learning, I mean, it's quite similar. I mean, I observed classes across the three types of schools and across three different parts of the country, in the Eastern province, the Western province, and in Kigali. And I think the main difference was the teachers, you know, just higher, better trained teachers, of course, in the better schools, better resources, so more textbooks. Some schools didn't even have textbooks. So the schools, say in a rural area outside of the capital, the students might, you know, they might not even understand, they didn't speak English at the time. So maybe the teacher would be translating into Kinyarwanda. The resources in the school weren't as nice. So they all had desks and tables, but maybe they didn't have many learning materials or they didn't have textbooks. So that those are the types of differences that I saw. But in terms of what they're actually learning, it's quite centralized. So you don't see as much variation from the policy perspective. And I think where you do see variation is what the teachers themselves decide they want to teach about. So right. I did find differences. Some teachers just didn't want to teach about these topics, you know, about the genocide, or because they're contentious and it's hard for them to talk about these topics, right? Because they don't know how the students will react. They don't know what questions will be asked. They might be accused of genocide ideology. So I think that was more what I saw as an avoidance of certain topics in some schools, whereas other teachers felt much more comfortable, particularly teachers who themselves were survivors, Tutsi survivors or returnees. They felt very comfortable talking about the genocide. So I think that was an interesting finding as well.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, that is interesting. Thank you for sharing that. It reminds me of something I learned in my own research. I met an American teacher. She was a teacher at one of the private schools in Kigali. And she was like, yeah, we're teaching the children of some of the RPF, but not that many, like they're elite kids. And we really stay away from teaching the genocide because we don't want to offend them. We don't know what they learn at home. And that conversation was very vivid in my mind when I was reading your book. And this is my next question. In terms of civics education, what is the barrier to full teaching? You mentioned genocide ideology. What is that and why does it affect the classroom?
Yeah, so the genocide ideology law from 2008, it's a law that it's seen as kind of any thoughts or acts or speech that incites people based on their ethnic group or origin. So it's a very sort of generally phrased law. And it was revised in 2013, but it's very vague. And I think that's part of the issue is there's a lot of fear. So amongst the teachers, because they don't know they could be accused of genocide ideology. I heard stories of students accusing their parents of ideology. So it came up in my research as just this thing to avoid, right? Being accused of ideology, right? Inciting violence between ethnic groups. And I think that's sort of tied to the restriction against talking about ethnicity. And I think those two things made it difficult for teachers to talk about the genocide, to teach about the genocide and really to talk about reconciliation in an open and genuine way. So it constrained open discussion in the classroom because teachers, depending on their own identity and background and level of comfort talking about these topics, might want to avoid discussing these things, because in their classroom at the time, I think one thing that's really interesting about when I was doing my work is that the classrooms were quite mixed. So there were, in the classroom, there were survivors of the genocide. There were returnees from, you know, who'd come back from Uganda or the DRC or Burundi, and children of perpetrators. So all in the classroom, right? So the teacher had to be very careful to navigate these topics, not only because they might be accused of inciting violence, but as you mentioned, you know, they might go and tell their parents, oh, you know, they talked about the double genocide, or there were certain taboo topics that were very taboo and teachers didn't want to mention because they were worried about the repercussions. So I think it points to the difficult role of the teacher in sort of mediating these different competing narratives that are outside of what the official curriculum talks about. And I think that was one thing that came out of my work.
Yeah, thanks for that answer. It sort of leads us to the meat of your findings, the core of your findings. And you mentioned it in your earlier response, like this official version of who did what to whom during the genocide and the savior role at the RPF. How much does this official narrative match what teachers believe to be accurate? Like, does history need to be accurate to be part of sustainable peace, as you say? Or, and this is really my question, is there a certain wisdom in what the RPF is doing and sort of crafting this common official history that this generation can eventually hold up as their own in pursuit of a future peace?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I'm not sure if I know the answer. I mean, I think on one hand, can history ever be accurate? I think it's very much depending on your perspective. And I think what historians try to do is provide different perspectives and provide the primary sources and allow for discussion about, you know, what is accurate. So mm-hmm. I think that's something that is missing now from the current presentation of the historical narrative. Is it's very much one-sided, you know, it doesn't allow for other narratives or other perspectives. And those come out a bit, you know, some of the teachers told me their experience, or, you know, one teacher in the Western province told me that he used other materials he'd found, like from Human Rights Watch, or, you know, that he himself knew about other versions of this history, or from, you know, his own experience. And I think, I think that's something that the teachers were aware of, and they questioned, and some of them said, you know, how am I supposed to teach about the genocide against the Tutsi when at the same time we don't have ethnicity anymore? So I think they struggled with the sort of the contradictions as well. So I think, you know, the common narrative on one hand, perhaps it keeps things from, you know, it avoids conflict or contentious discussions in the classroom, but I think students and teachers question this narrative privately. So they might not talk about it in the classroom, but definitely in the interviews, they would, you know, they would talk about it. And they had their own narratives that came from their own lived experiences or their family experiences. So while the students probably were too young to remember, their families were affected. So one student told me that, you know, he lost his father after the genocide, you know, his father was killed by the RPF. So I think that's the issue, is that when you have the lived narratives that come from the community or the family, and that goes in contrast to what's coming from the government or the official narrative, that's where you have this sort of tension.
Right.
And I think it'd be interesting now, because it's been so long and the students don't have any kind of, you know, memory maybe from their family, but it would be interesting to see how it is now. It might be different now. You know, when I was there, it was
sure
closer to when it had happened.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting response, and it sort of speaks to the title of your book, Becoming Rwandan. What is the role of a partial history? I think, to state it generously, what is the role of this official history in the government's vision for crafting, for lack of a better word, a particular kind of Rwandan citizen? Obviously, education is part of that socialization. So did that come up in your research at all?
Yeah, so I really felt like they they saw the school as this site to build this new Rwandan identity. So very much de-emphasizing ethnicity. So this idea that, you know, these are children, right? So you can sort of erase this idea of ethnic identity and create this new Rwandan-ness, you know, Abanyarwanda. And so I definitely saw that in the school. And I think that comes out, you know, with this idea of the new, everything is new, you know, the new curriculum, the new language of instruction, English, the new citizen. They have a very much of a global orientation, talking about these global ideas. And I think on one hand, they try to do that. And the students never themselves mentioned ethnicity. They didn't self-identify in ethnic terms, yet it's still very much there, sort of indirectly. So I think they would talk about other groups like, oh, those survivors, or those people who came from such and such a country. So it was more what I found, that it was more about where you were during the genocide. So if you were a survivor or a returnee, and the language you spoke. So there was very much like an Anglophone versus Francophone divide. But I think there were sort of like proxies for indicating if they were Tutsi or not. Whereas with the teacher, the older generation, you know, they were open about their ethnic identity.
Right.
They didn't feel that they had to hide it. So I think that to me is very interesting, how they are creating this new narrative. And I think the students know that they know not to talk about it, but yet if their parents or family members are talking about it, it's not like you can completely, you know, get rid of ethnicity, even if it is socially constructed, right? So I think that's what's quite interesting about what they're trying to do with the schools.
Yeah, and that's my next question. I appreciate that answer because it leads us to like this global model. Why would the RPF embrace a global model if it has very particular outcomes in mind, you know, the erasure of ethnicity or the suppression of ethnicity, this intention to become, quote unquote, Rwandan? Of course, there's still, your title is great because they're still in a process of becoming. So what is the value of the global model and what is its content for the Rwandan education system?
Yeah, I'm trained as a sociologist, and I think the work I draw on, I mean, it really just talks about why, you know, why countries are drawn these global models, and it's really about ideas about legitimacy, right? So to be seen as legitimate, and also for donors, you know, I think I argue that they privilege certain topics. So they talk about human rights, but they talk more about social and economic rights more than, say, contested political and civil rights. And then women's rights and gender equality is a focus. And you see that also in the education materials and the policy documents. And I think that's something that it sort of provides them something that the international community recognizes. And, okay, they're doing really well in this area. So it's a way for them to gain legitimacy. So that's kind of how I see it. I mean, do they really need to refer to all these global models? No, but by doing so, it sort of highlights what they're doing and, you know, gets the attention of the international community, I would say.
Thanks for that. Do you have any insights? Like, did your research come to find that the government is actually on the right track? Is there a wisdom to this policy in terms of like creating a model Rwandan citizen, or is this reproducing, you know, the experiential categories of in and out groups, just not using ethnicity as the construct, as you noted?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. What I found was that there are still differences. There are still groups, I call them boundaries. Boundaries are still emerging across these different groups.
Right.
And it's because at the time when I was there, they still had scholarships, the FARGE, the Genocide Survivors Assistance Fund, and the ARG, which was the association for these survivors. They had clubs and scholarships specifically for genocide survivors, so they were still singling them out as being different. And then, of course, when they talk about the genocide, it's always the genocide against the Tutsi, which, you know, the name also changed, right, over the years.
Yeah.
So I think on one hand, they are promoting this Rwandan-ness, but then on the other hand, in certain contexts, they continue to promote ethnic terms or ethnic identity. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I think on one hand, the students tended to be optimistic. I think they were happy that there was stability and peace, sure, and that, you know, if there's economic growth and stability, I think generally people are content. But if things go, you know, go wrong in that front, then underneath, you know, I think there's a lot that hasn't been talked about openly, and there's resentment and tensions that aren't discussed. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how successful this project is.
Let me ask you a specific question in my own discipline, peace and conflict studies. Mm-hmm. Is the peace that the RPF has, you know, promoted, produced, even, I think you could argue, sustainable in the way you describe in your text? So yeah, two questions. What is sustainable peace, and has mm-hmm. the RPF actually made strides towards like enacting that goal?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's hard to say. I mean, I think on the surface, it looks successful on the surface, because, you know, they've had these different initiatives, you know, Gachacha and the different programs to foster reconciliation and unity. But I think it's hard to say whether this is sustainable. I mean, I would argue that what's happening in the classroom or what's happening in the schools is not genuinely promoting peace building. I think it's more glossing over the past and sort of skirting around the real issues. I mean, I think they've also turned their focus really to math and science and technology and right, sort of avoided the more contentious issues. Yeah, I mean, that's something that you see as well in the schools. Like, very, very little time is actually devoted to talking about these topics to begin with. I mean, it's there, which is good, but it's not the main focus. So I think the government is saying, well, we can just focus on developing and development, and that'll lead to peace building. But I think it's hard to say whether that's actually the case, because so much has not really been addressed, and there's a lot under the surface that I think is still needing to be discussed.
It's really interesting your answer, because of course you could probably make the same argument about American schools that we spend less on civics.
Yeah.
You know, depending on the state, obviously there's a different structure in the US, but I think that's what's so emblematic of a case study. It can be applied to other settings, and your work in Rwanda could certainly be applied to school curricula here in the US for sure. Because peace is one of these amorphous things. When I was reading your book, I was thinking about a concept that Roger McGinty introduced to the literature called everyday peace. Mm-hmm. He writes about sort of the social practices, the conviviality, the sociality of what makes a society peaceful. And he ultimately concluded, using Northern Ireland as his primary case study, that social practices give the appearance of peace. And it can be difficult for analysts, like, you know, scholars like us, to actually know what people are thinking. And that's where I think your book is interesting. You begin to reveal, you know, a snapshot in time that teachers are thinking this way, students are feeling that way, and there's a range of opinion. And I think it's an important contribution in that regard. And this is, you know, one of my last questions. I've taken up a lot of your time. Is the work that you design, the research you design, the research you implemented possible in present day Rwanda? You know, COVID notwithstanding, let's assume that COVID is not shaping how we access the field and so on. But is your study possible today, 10 years later?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's grown increasingly difficult to do research in Rwanda. So when I was there, I got permission from the Ministry of Education and from the schools, and of course, you know, consent from the participants. But I think over the years it's gotten increasingly difficult, and the research coming out on education is not necessarily on these sort of contentious topics. I think it's more on sort of quality of education and that kind of thing, language policy.
Student outcome.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I think it would be difficult to conduct this research now. I think at the time when I did this, it I was fortunate. I think I was able to gain the trust of teachers and students, and by spending time in the classroom. And I also did some of the interviews in French, and I think that helped with some of the teachers who were Francophone or some of the students who had been educated mostly in French. And I think, my status as an outsider helped, because I don't think they would have necessarily shared this with a Rwandan. I think it would be difficult. I think over the years, it's gotten more difficult to conduct this type of work.
Yeah, I agree with you on many levels. And of course, trust is hard to build, but I take your point. There are some topics in authoritarian settings, just not the Rwandan setting, but any authoritarian setting, in which it's easier to speak to an outsider.
Yeah.
And being a white American, like, you're very clearly an outsider. So with that sort of in mind, I'll ask you a final question, and then you can ask me anything maybe I forgot to ask, or something you wanted to say. Are there books or podcasts or any, documentaries that you would recommend for listeners who want to learn more about, education for peace building, or the process of becoming Rwandan in the Rwandan studies literature?
I think Elizabeth King's work, From Classroom to Conflict in Rwanda, is a great book that sort of outlines the history of the education system and the role it played in fueling the conflict. I see my work as sort of looking more at the post-genocide context. And then also Tim Williams does a lot of really interesting work, also looking more sort of at what's happened since they've expanded access to education. So I think for scholars interested in Rwanda and specifically education, those are two people that I would recommend.
Or anything on education for peace building? Is there what literature really stood out for you
for education? And
on the global model,
I think it's sort of I guess one thing I wanted to do with my work is highlight the role of education, because I think it's sort of it's usually not part of the discussion, education, right? So I think that's
true.
That's kind of part of my work, is this, it's a gap in the literature. I mean, a lot of the peace building literature, political science, it's more looking at political structures and economic developments, but education is seen as being sort of apolitical or neutral, and it's really not. And I think what my work shows is that something as seemingly simple as the curriculum or the language policy is in fact very political. And I think it's an area that there's stuff coming out, but I'd say an area that is in need of future research. One person, Julia Paulson, does work on this in different contexts. She's done work in Peru, and I think that's, there are a few people working on this topic, but it's not given as much attention as one would expect.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I think you're right. And it is taken for granted in ways that political scientists, my own discipline, don't often fully recognize. So thank you for that answer. Is there anything that I didn't ask that you wanted to share with listeners?
So I just wanted to pick up on a few things that you had said earlier that I thought were important to emphasize. So one is just that what I really wanted to do with my work is highlight the perspective of the students and the teachers. And I think that's important. That's what comes out of this is, it's not so much what I think, but it's really, coming from them and what they think. So that's important. And then I think what you mentioned about the relevance of this work to other cases is also really important. I've done work in other contexts as well, and divided societies, South Africa, and I've done work in the United States with refugee students and newcomer students. And also I'm doing some work in Colombia. And I think, what I found in Rwanda is also true in other contexts. So I think that's important to highlight. It's hard to talk about these topics in divided societies. It's even harder if it's a more authoritarian, non-democratic context, obviously. But I think a lot of what I found in Rwanda could also be applied to, the U.S. in the current day, our own society. We're having a lot of difficult discussions, and there's a lot that hasn't been talked about, a lot about, our past and the violence that's happening now, the police brutality and, you know, Black Lives Matter movement that stems from, I would say, that the fact that we haven't really reckoned with our own history and our own past. So it's just been really interesting for me as someone who studies these topics to see this happening, this reflection kind of going on right now here in the US.
Thank you, Garnet. That's a great way to end our conversation. You've been listening to Garnet Russell talk about her book, Becoming Rwandan: Education, Reconciliation, and the Making of a Post-Genocide Citizen. Thank you.